I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Many people in and outside Iraq are imagining a day when Saddam Hussein might be put on trial for his decades of tyranny. But who would choose the judge and who would be the jurors? Would it be a war crimes trial run by the UN? Would it be an Iraqi courtroom or a U.S. military tribunal? And there are more questions. Would such tribunals involve crimes against Iraqis or people in other countries as well? And it gets even more complicated when you try to draw up a list of who else deserves to be tried in Iraq, and by whom, and for what. Well, there are many models of justice to choose from, and strong arguments to support each. Some will say that, as an occupying force, the U.S. has an obligation to ensure that punishment is handed out fairly. Others say that the U.S. will not, cannot be seen as a neutral force here. So, Connection listeners, how much responsibility should Iraqis themselves have to decide how the war crimes are handled? And what should be the overall goal of these trials? Is it retribution against those who committed atrocities or a public reckoning with 30 years of oppression? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today, Charles Forrest. He's head of an organization called Indict. For the past 6 years, this group's been preparing for the moment when Iraqis are brought to justice. Charles is joining us from a BBC studio in London. And with me in Boston is Samantha Power. This year, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. She teaches U.S. foreign policy and human rights at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Charles, I'm going to start with you because I'm a little bit confused about something. When I first read about Indict, your group was calling for a lot of international involvement in bringing Iraqis to justice. And recently, I'm reading that, in fact, you prefer almost directly U.S. Backing here rather than U.N. or others. Have I got that part right?
Well, the original goal of Indict was to campaign for the creation of a special ad hoc United Nations tribunal to deal with the crimes of the Iraqi regime. And I think that that would have been very effective before the overthrow of the regime as a way of focusing attention on the violations of human rights in Iraq and undermining the legitimacy of the regime. Mm-hmm. And might have led to a situation where we didn't need to go to war against Iraq. But now that the regime has been overthrown, I think that we need to focus on setting up a system of justice that satisfies the Iraqi people, who, after all, were the victims of most of these crimes. And there's been a lot of discussion by Iraqi judges and lawyers and people involved in the opposition politics. And generally, they agree that this is something that should be done in Iraq by Iraqi judges. Of course, it'll require a lot of assistance from the United States, a lot of technical help, a lot of assistance with prosecution and investigation. And this appears to be the policy of the United States, to support the creation of an Iraqi tribunal.
And you think that could work?
I think it could work. I think it's going to be difficult. It requires a commitment. And the United States has to make a commitment in many different fields to working in Iraq to develop democracy and the rule of law and to bring the country into a position where the United States forces, the other coalition forces, can leave and won't leave behind a country which is ripe for the return of totalitarian rule like the Ba'ath Party.
Okay, now just one more before I turn to Samantha. You were in Iraq recently, am I right?
Yes, I just returned yesterday.
And did you get any idea while you were there that there are the pieces of a judicial system that could be put back together, one that people would trust?
Well, I think that the current judicial system is really totally unequipped to deal with these types of cases. I think we can operate to a certain degree under Iraqi law, and we can find Iraqis with the judicial training, probably for the most part, retired judges or people who've been in exile, mm-hmm. or judges from the Kurdish region in the north who could serve on this court. But it's going to require a very special court with significant changes in its procedure. It can't be run under the standard code of criminal procedure that applies in Iraq today, which has an investigative judge process. And it's going to have a much stronger prosecutor, and it's going to have much stronger guarantees for the defense. But with those considerations in mind, I do think it is possible, and I think it's really the only solution that is going to satisfy the Iraqi people.
Samantha, I wonder if we're a little bit ahead of ourselves here in you know, deciding how it works. Do you need to think first about what the tribunals or the trials are for? What's what you're out to accomplish with them?
Well, I think that's a that's an excellent question, which we have been too slow to ask in the case of previous judicial mechanisms that have been set up in Rwanda, in for the former Yugoslavia, East Timor, Sierra Leone. There's so many different forms that justice can take. I think intuitively, perhaps, we reflexively think of it as retribution. And this is something that's, I think, basic to mankind everywhere. Basically, somebody did a bad thing.
You're not saying it's a bad thing to focus on.
Not at all. It's a first-order function of judicial processes. But often, it's not the only function. We can look, in Iraq especially, and also in the other examples that we have before us, at incapacitation, also just getting people out of society so that they aren't destabilizing the peace. Deterrence.
Incapacitation means you had this role in the Ba'ath Party, therefore you can no longer hold public office. You have to go live in a farm somewhere.
So either you have to go and serve a sentence of some kind, or if you look at in Eastern Europe, actually, where you didn't have judicial models for retribution, you had laws that prevented people who had spied for the communist government from holding public office and from achieving senior ranks mm-hmm. in society, lustres laws that Tina Rosenberg has actually written beautifully about in her book, The Haunted Land. So you have a way of using justice basically as a way of keeping people down who would otherwise be leading lights and potentially destabilizing lights. One of the examples of this working very, very well in the Yugoslav case is the court in The Hague introduced something called a secret indictment. And this seems quite intuitive. You don't want to warn people that you're going to come to arrest them. But prior to that point, we'd had lists, sort of like the card deck in Iraq, mm-hmm. lists of people who were, leading suspects. And then the secret indictment came along, and suddenly anybody who had blood on their hands began to worry that they were on the list somewhere. So it ceased to be predictable, and thus people who might, again, otherwise have destabilized may not have been leading perpetrators of the genocide in Bosnia, but they went underground and were much less high-profile in their society. So there are a couple functions. But then there's a whole other sector, which is kind of the reconciliation or the coexistence sector, where the trials could perform functions such as truth-telling. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we get people to come forward and actually acknowledge the role that they played in abetting the Ba'ath Party or in playing an active role in the Ba'ath Party in committing abuses? Maybe these are people not high-level enough to warrant, you know, the resources the trials will actually require. They certainly wouldn't make it into the card deck, but they may be people who are deeply resented by their neighbors.
These are like the prison guards in South Africa who talked about executing prisoners, saying that they were following the orders of their political masters.
Exactly.
Right?
And you can imagine in a society like this one, laden with informants, how many people like this there are, either the abusers or the people who made the abuse possible. You also have historical record building. Is there a way in a multi-ethnic society like this one, in a multi-plural society like this one, to create some kind of shared historical record of what it was that went on under Saddam Hussein? I mean, this is a function that Nuremberg played, for instance, giving Germans the opportunity 20 years after the trials to dip back into the historical record when they were ready as a society, and you had thousands and thousands of pages, tons of documents available for the society.
Charles, back to you. What were the people in Baghdad, the people that you met in northern Iraq, what are they wanting? You've just got this list from Samantha of options of what justice can do. Was there any sort of common theme to what people were telling you?
Well, I think that it's essential that the stories be told, that the victims have a right to learn the truth about what happened to their relatives. And we're seeing this all over Iraq right now, where mass graves are being discovered and people are feverishly trying to dig up the bodies and looking for their relatives. But also there's fear. There's still a lot of fear left throughout Iraq that Saddam Hussein is still out there, that other senior Ba'ath Party leaders are still capable of coming back. And people have told me, you know, if the Americans left within 24 hours, Saddam and the Ba'ath Party would be back in power because they have that organization out there. So that has to be broken. And, it has to be done not necessarily through judicial means. I mean, these people have to be rounded up and removed from society. But it's very urgent because there's already a lot of retribution going on. I've heard stories about several people a day are being killed in certain parts of Baghdad, Ba'athists who are being the victims of mob violence. So it's essential that all of these things be dealt with very quickly, or else it could bubble over. I mean, right now people are more concerned about getting the electricity and the water back on, but ultimately these are the real key issues in society there.
What, Samantha, of that list that you went through, in your experience, needs to be number one on the list of priorities? Where do you go first?
Well, I think there's no way to avoid the retributive impulse that people have, and this is what Charles is talking about.
Right.
The impulse for vengeance gets played out in judicial processes when they're functional. I mean, that's how we channel all of our grievances. So I don't think one can by any means dismiss that as a function. The tricky sector of society is the sector that hasn't perhaps killed, but that has been complicit in killing, in torturing, in burying bodies in those mass graves. And just as Charles mentioned, the challenge in any post-atrocity society, and especially any post-totalitarian one, is trust. And since it's a chicken and egg problem, because people aren't going to be prone to come forward to acknowledge, to confess that they have played a role, to apologize perhaps to victims or the survivors or the families of victims, if they don't feel that they're in turn going to get added to some ever expanding card deck. Similarly, victims, as was said, aren't going to feel comfortable coming forward and actually confessing and bringing forward what they have suffered if they don't feel that the Ba'ath Party is a permanent chapter in the distant past. So part of what has to happen, it all has to happen at once, and God knows both the Iraqis and the international, so-called international community, have their hands full, because you need a secure environment where vengeance isn't happening, as it was said, at two killings a day, mm-hmm. where victims feel that they can get not merely the truth off their chest, but actually that they have a willing interlocutor on the other side. And that often takes time. So on the one hand, we have this impulse for speedy justice because we want to stem the vengeance and channel it. On the other hand, we need to give the wounds a little bit, time to sort of harden so that people can get back into the same room. And it's that sector of society that isn't going to end up necessarily on a list somewhere as leading perpetrators, but that was very implicated in what went on, that we really need to focus our attentions on. And I don't think we do that instinctively.
And Charles, it's I suppose that the people in Iraq need to know that something is coming, even if it's not there right now. They need to know that these ideas are being talked about and something is going to be put in place.
Well, I think the problem is right now it's still not clear who's in charge. If it's the United States that's making the decisions, what is the ultimate goal of our presence there? On the one hand, we hear talk about de-Ba'athification, but on the other hand, the ORHA, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Affairs, is very concerned about keeping ministries going, and they're reaching out to people that they call technocrats. And of course, these people got their positions during the Ba'ath regime. So it's a very difficult balance. On the one hand, you want to get the electricity and water running again. And if you have to use people who are Ba'athists, then I think you have to have a strategy for how they're going to ultimately be removed from their positions of authority.
All right. We'll pick that up when we come back after our break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're talking about war crimes in Iraq, crimes that came before the war as well. Punishment. Connection listeners, after 3 decades of dictatorship under Saddam Hussein, Iraqis are prepared to handle war crimes trials themselves, take some advice from the United States? Is international law, international involvement important? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me in the studio, Samantha Power. She's author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. She also teaches human rights and U.S. foreign policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Charles Forrest is with us from a BBC studio. He's chief executive officer of Indict. It's a London-based organization seeking to indict Iraqi war criminals, an organization that in recent years has got a little bit of financial assistance from the U.S. government. Samantha, if I can, I want to start with you, because when we talk about what the Iraqis can do and what the Americans can do to assist them, we're kind of leaving off the list the rest of the world, either through the UN or through some kind of international organization, I think in part because this administration hasn't in any way or under any circumstances reached out to international law. So is it logical just to leave them out of this equation?
Well, it wouldn't be my preference, not because I have any particular romantic idea of the United Nations and the pace, at least, at which it tends to set up operations and the expediency with which it actually prosecutes crimes like this. But the reason to look to the UN is really twofold. One, the appearance of legitimacy locally. I mean, if it were to appear to the Iraqis that the United States was both the maker or the shaper of laws and the enforcers of laws, or actually and the prosecutor and the judge, that would undermine the legitimacy of the court. Whereas, again, the appearance of things international tends to deflect some of those charges.
Why would it undermine it, though? I mean, in this country, Americans know that their lawmakers make laws and then enforce those laws.
No, we have a legislature that makes the laws and then a judicial system that enforces them. Obviously, offices of the prosecutor are separate from also offices of the judge. And I think there, while there may be nuances like that in place in an American-run court system, those will probably be lost on the Iraqis. So it's sort of the appearance of international legitimacy, but not merely the appearance. The international courts that have been put in place are hybrids of the Anglo-American model and the continental tradition. Charles mentioned that the Iraqi tradition is to have a very strong investigative judge that does much of the interrogation himself, and that this is a model we should move away from. Certainly we should move away from the Ba'ath Party version of it, which is nothing resembling a legitimate independent judiciary. But there may be a case to be made that in order to maintain legitimacy or the appearance that this is an Iraqi court, that actually we do need to come up with some kind of hybrid model that brings together the best of the traditional Iraqi justice system, such as it was prior to the advent of Saddam Hussein, and some of the lessons that I think we can learn from the international cadre of lawyers, prosecutors, and judges who have actually serviced the two war crimes tribunals for the better part of the last 10 years. They have a lot of lessons to teach, both about what to do and definitely about what not to do. And I would just hate to see whatever court this is that gets set up, whether it's predominantly Iraqi or predominantly American or, some kind of mix of all of the above, sort of try to reinvent the wheel that has actually been turning over the course of the last decade, not only in for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, but as I mentioned, also for East Timor and Sierra Leone, mm-hmm. and now perhaps in the coming months for Cambodia. There's a lot of learning out there that we can mine, I think, for this experience.
And Charles, is there an eagerness in Iraq to take advantage of that expertise, whether or not it comes from one of the tribunals in Africa or from The Hague or even from among that group of people who've learned this with the UN?
Well, I think definitely it would be very helpful to have people with experience in those tribunals participating in the work of this tribunal. But I think that putting this under the aegis of the United Nations would be a mistake, because I think that the UN bureaucracy, as Samantha mentioned, is really not equipped to move as quickly as would be needed here. And also, I mean, we may find that there's just an unwillingness on the part of the Security Council, the French in particular, to support such a court, because it would be seen as retroactively legitimizing the war. I think that we can learn from the lessons of the other courts, and we can draw on the expertise. But I still think that the proof of the legitimacy of the court in the eyes of the Iraqis will be in the way that the trials are carried out, not whether it's funded by the United States or set up by the United States. The United States is in the process, or the coalition is in the process, of very quickly trying to put a transitional government into place. And there will be a judicial component of this transitional government. An independent judiciary will be created. And I think that if the tribunal is created in the context of that process, it won't simply be seen as a U.S. Imposition. It will be seen as a real Iraqi court. And ultimately, I think the real reason why I think this is important is if you look at the Hague Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, it really is distant from the reality in the former Yugoslavia. It's a court that is far off, has only tried a very small number of cases, and really hasn't had an impact on the development of the judiciary or the rule of law in the countries of the former Yugoslavia. And I think that the most important function that this tribunal can play in the long run is to really lay the foundation for the rule of law in Iraq. I think that we want to do something which will be a model to the people of Iraq, that they'll see how this is working and see how important it is to their society in the future.
Samantha?
If I could just get in, I think it's an excellent point, and one of the functions that I meant to lay out at the beginning that these courts do perform is just that you mentioned, which is strengthening national judicial systems, both by holding exemplary trials, but also by training judges and lawyers in order to carry out this select number of trials against leading perpetrators. But then you're left with a trained cadre of judges and lawyers. The other function is that it establishes, these courts can establish individual responsibility, this goes without saying, I suppose, but to do away with collective guilt so that not everyone associated with the Ba'ath Party is branded by the same brush. And I couldn't agree more that both the Yugoslav and the Rwanda Tribunal, which is right next door to Rwanda in Arusha, isn't, you know, a continent, half a continent away, as the Hague Tribunal is from Yugoslavia. Both those courts have done an absolutely lousy job communicating their proceedings and their messages back home to the people in whose name justice is being done. So there's just no question that these courts would be best built in Iraq, despite the risk of the appearance of victor's justice. But I think we I agree also that perhaps a UN tribunal is not at all what we should have in mind for the Iraqis. What I'm suggesting is that there are other models out there. The UN tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia have been costing about $100 million a year. That's just a fraction of what we as an international community have pumped back into the societies that are actually themselves trying to deal with, the post-atrocity landscape. That money could be much better spent, as you suggest, in Iraq proper rather than having these courts outside. But if you look, for instance, to Sierra Leone, that lesson has already been learned. Instead of setting up a cumbersome, $100 million international tribunal, on the other side of Africa so as to maintain the appearance of impartiality, there is a hybrid court now that has been set up in Freetown that is half Sierra Leone judges and half international, half Sierra Leonean prosecutors and half international. The court goes out into the community to solicit feedback on the proceedings and indeed to sort of cultivate an awareness of the court to do expectation management, I think, which is also a crucial
function. And at the street level, Samantha, are people paying attention? Does it matter?
Much, much more, because they feel that they have been solicited, that it is their judicial process rather than something artificial from the outside. And that's what we have to be worried about. You could have a court system in Baghdad and people could still feel like it's an external creation. And as Charles has suggested, we want to make this as organic and as true to the spirit of what Iraq can be as possible.
All right, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and John's been waiting on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I just want to say this. I think it's extremely important that we keep in mind that Iraq has become a sort of, stage for the rest of how the various Islamic nations and the people who are Islamic view us as a nation. And I think it's really important not to try to do what many victors do, and that is infantilize the population by telling them what's best for them. And what I think is important is that any trials that take place have to be fully supported by the people of Iraq, that they have to feel that it is their form of justice. And truth and reconciliation kind of tribunals, or whatever they decide to come up with, has to be there to meet their needs and not to meet ours, because I think that ultimately we're just playing into the hands of the sort of, Islamic fanatics who want to destroy our way of life and our nation, and et cetera, by trying to impose our value system on that Iraqi population.
You know, one of the features of that, John, and just stay with me because I want to hear a bit from Charles on this, is goes back to the very first question that we talked about on the program in terms of what are these trials set out to do? Because if they go back 30 years, then you're talking about war crimes against Iran, war crimes against the Kuwaitis, against
sure.
Saudis, against as well as all of the people inside. And Charles, I don't know if under those circumstances, U.S. involvement becomes even more complicated, because in with that mix is war crimes against Americans, those who plotted an assassination against the president's father, that sort of thing.
Well, I think the United States is still reserving the right to try people who've committed crimes against Americans in the U.S. military justice system, and that's why some of the issues are still vague as to what U.S. policy is. They're still trying to decide whether they want to try some of these people in the U.S. system. But just one very practical point that I think has come up and should be emphasized is that a large part of the enormous cost of the Hague Tribunal is just translation. Millions of documents have to be translated into English and French, and then into the three different so-called languages of
and the fat UN salaries. Don't forget the fat UN salaries.
But one thing that has been emphasized by the Iraqi judges and lawyers, and there is a group of them that have been working on this issue for almost a year now. It's called the Transitional Justice Working Group, which was sponsored by the State Department. One thing they've emphasized is that this should be entirely in Arabic. So if we do have any international judges participating in this, they should probably be from other Arab countries. And in doing so, I think that we'll keep it much closer to the expectations of the Iraqi people, and we'll address some of the issues that the caller has raised there about perceptions in the Arab and Islamic world.
At the end of the day, though, John, what matters most is how Iraqis see the system rather than how the Saudis or the Iranians see it, though, no?
Well, yeah, except that I think that, you know, Iraq is actually sort of an international or at least a regional test case in terms of how the rest of the region is going to respond to us going forward.
Right. So if the Iraqis buy into whatever's put in place, it becomes a little harder for folks in Damascus to say the system stinks.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin now, and Amir's on the line. Hi, Amir.
Hi. I'm an American of Iranian descent, and a few years back I had traveled to Iran, and during my time there, I personally had seen many people which had been chemically destroyed, their face, their body, by the war between Iran and Iraq and what the Iraqis had done to the Iranians. I was very much saddened by what I had seen, and just by listening to your program and hearing you talk about, you know, retributions and people being held accountable for things they did, and, you know, I just wanted to say that I hope that they're also held accountable for many of the atrocities that they committed against the Iranians, which they invaded their country, and that's basically it. That's what I had to say, and thank you for your time.
All right, Amir, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Samantha, is there any precedent for that kind of bilateral... That's a terrible word to use. You know what I'm talking about here. Is there any way in a war crimes trial, such as the ones that we're talking about here, where the crimes against Iranians can be specifically addressed? I mean, because that might have some significant repercussions in the region if we go back to, you know, John's earlier call.
Yeah, I think it would certainly represent something of an olive branch from the Iraqi regime to say, you know, we take the crimes committed against our neighbors as seriously as those against ourselves. I'm trying to think of precedents. I mean, Nuremberg, of course, was widely slandered as a victor's justice tribunal because it was, you know, sort of manned by the victors. But also the principal crime prosecuted in Nuremberg was not crimes against humanity, as we now remember it, but crime against peace. So it was actually, you know, the crime of aggression, mm-hmm. you know, that Germany had crossed borders. And in fact, if you remember, according to the Nuremberg Statute, if the Germans had confined their killing of Jews to those within Germany, there would have actually been no jurisdiction, according to the Nuremberg Charter, for the prosecutions that took place. So part of what one, I suppose, has to ask is, what are the priorities? We've been talking, I think, Charles and I and you have been talking about stability and reconciliation within Iraq. And given that we have limited resources, that the Iraqis have limited resources at their disposal, and God knows I would like to be the last person to infantilize the Iraqis. This is very much their process. But I do think we have to keep in mind the in the leadership vacuum that exists right now, the kind of influence the United States has. And so it's still very important to raise questions in terms of what the American instinct should be and to ask them to ask questions that they should be asking. But with limited resources, where do you go first, and how do you sort of reinforce, you know, the attempt to establish police security on the ground, not of the traditional Ba'ath kind, but mm-hmm. of a more civic kind, as well as you know, military security in the course of putting down rebellions and trying to stave off vengeance. And it may be that what you need is a kind of tiered justice system, where Iranian input is brought in at a later stage after you focus first and foremost on, you know, trying to restore relations among Iraqis.
And Charles, is that even being talked about at this point?
Well, I think that we have to find some way to separate the process of developing the historical record from, you know, the direct process of criminal trials. I mean, if Saddam Hussein is still alive, if he is actually brought before a court, it would be impossible to try him for all the crimes he's committed. It would take 10 years at least. And I think it's important to focus on some kind of relatively concise set of crimes, see that he receives the maximum punishment, whether that's life imprisonment or death. And I think that the historical record should be developed in the context of a truth and reconciliation process and also some kind of a historical commission. And I think this is one of the mistakes of the trials in the Hague Tribunal. I mean, the trial of Slobodan Milosevic goes on for 2 years, and it really doesn't resemble a real criminal trial. It's more of a historical seminar in many respects. And we can't have a 2-year trial of Saddam Hussein.
All right. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour we're exploring the different options for dealing with justice in Iraq, talking about war crimes, talking about the past 30 years under Saddam Hussein. What is it that the people in that country want? What is it that their neighbors want? And what is it that the rest of the world is waiting to see? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Charles Forrest, head of Indict, the London-based organization, which has been working for some 6 years now to find ways of indicting Iraqi war criminals. He's just back from a couple of weeks in Baghdad in northern Iraq. Samantha Powers here with me in Boston. She's a professor of human rights and U.S. foreign policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for this year in the category of general nonfiction. And we're talking about the very nonfiction world of justice in Iraq and the difficulties of trying to find ways of resolving some of the issues there. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now Richard is with us. Hi, Richard.
Hello. I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
If the U.S. tries Ba'athists for any sort of war crimes, this will be extremely unfair unless the same standards are used against those who were on the U.S. side. Now, some of the things that might be called war crimes that were committed by U.S. or Bush forces were the use of depleted uranium, cluster bombs on civilian areas, destroying electrical plants that were needed to make the water supply function, which endangers the lives of lots of civilians, key keeping medicine out, even though supposedly the sanctions allowed medicine to be imported. I'm not going to say that that people who murdered and tortured for Saddam shouldn't be punished, but if the U.S. arranges to try and punish them but exempts those who were working for Bush, it will be an obvious injustice, and everyone will see that.
And Charles, is there a way of setting up any kind of structure that allows the issues that Richard's raising to be put on the record?
Well, you know, I don't think those issues are really substantive. I think that, you know, the United States has a legal system. War crimes, violations of the Geneva Convention are can be prosecuted under United States law. The cases that the callers mentioned there, I mean, things happen in war. People get killed in war. A war crime is a gross violation of the laws of war, which prohibit certain activities. And you know, when you talk, for example, about the sanctions, I mean, the propaganda that has been used by the Ba'athist regime about the sanctions can easily be disproved, or was disproved in my mind, by a visit to the northern part of Iraq, which was under Kurdish control, and Baghdad, which was under Saddam's control. I mean, both of these parts of Iraq had access to the same amount of money under the UN Oil for Food program. And in northern Iraq, the people had adequate medical supplies. They had adequate food. In the areas controlled by Saddam, they did not. And the sole reason for that was the looting of the Iraqi economy by Saddam's regime. And a lot of the other stories that have been told by the Ba'athist regime, I think over the years, we have to focus on levels of real responsibility, that this is a regime that used chemical weapons against the Kurdish people. It killed hundreds of thousands of people, mass executions in the south. It committed genocide against the Marsh Arabs.
I'm actually not raising any questions about any of that, but rather trying to get at this in a more philosophical way. If there are people in Iraq who believe that the bombing of Baghdad was a crime against the people in that city, if there are people in Iraq who think that a misguided smart bomb that took out a bus that had my two kids on it is a war crime, does that perception get addressed in these types of fora? I don't know, Samantha, whether or not, it may be just the opportunity to say that would give some satisfaction to the
Well, this is again one of those functions on the list, right? Is victim acknowledgement, and to sort of restore the dignity and the voice to people who've been deprived it for all these years. And part of giving people a voice means not censoring it. So if that's what they choose to come to court to say, unfortunately, it is an adversarial, or fortunately, it is an adversarial process. So there are limits in terms of the digressions that will be allowed. And this may be seen to be an aggression if what's on trial is an Iraqi official. But I think that there will be outlets, and in addition, of course, if in fact this truth commission is set up, which will deal with the sort of the really tricky sector of the society, you know, where the sort of informants are dealing with the victims at a day-to-day level. I think that's also a space where this kind of conversation can happen. There is, as Charles suggested, a very robust courts-martial process within the U.S. military. But I have to say, the military does a very bad job giving transparency to that process to allay, again, the appearance and, as you say, the perception that these war crimes have been committed. And I think it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. Just as the Iraqis need to be given the voice, I think also the Americans need to expose their processes of looking inward.
Or open themselves up to examination or to discussion. Examination, discussion is probably a better word. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Hillsborough, North Carolina now. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you all?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I appreciate Indict's lengthy struggle for change, but I do wonder somewhat about the aid and enthusiasm of the U.S. government here, looking, sort of contrasting that with the hands-off policy toward the Suharto regime ongoing and its genocidal activities in East Timor, which I think, if you look at that, pretty much at very least parallels what Saddam did. I think you could argue that it was a lot worse. And so I kind of think that we're looking somewhat at justification here and not justice. I wonder how and the rest of the world sees that hypocrisy.
That now is the time to talk about the liberation of Iraq rather than the national security of the United States and weapons of mass destruction? Is it that kind of two sides that you're talking about, Bob?
I guess I just want some consistency. We're all hot to bring Saddam to justice. We're talking about the death penalty, and yet I think that our credibility is at stake here. It's fair enough to talk about it, but if you talk about it in a vacuum, it just doesn't have that moral authority.
Well, I know, Samantha, you've written at some length on the way that the United States policy towards people who live in other countries is constantly deserves to be challenged and questioned, and most of what you've written comes at that from a human rights point of view. Where was the United States at the time of all the killing in Rwanda? Where was the United States in Indonesia at a time when the East Timorese were being so persecuted by the Indonesians? Is this a moment, in your view, for the United States to take some kind of principled stand on the issue of human rights, humanitarian considerations? You're smiling a little bit.
Sure. I'll take this moment. Any moment will do. I think, look, as the caller suggested, mere genocide, and I hate to be the one to put it that way, but mere genocide hasn't ranked traditionally in American foreign policy. While Saddam was carrying out the genocide against the Kurds, carrying out the chemical weapons attacks, destroying 2,000 villages, we were aligned with his regime, as is now widely documented, giving him $500 million a year in farm credits. That program was doubled the year after the gassing and the genocide. I think it's a wonderful moment to say, look, to come forward, and instead of Don Rumsfeld pretending that wasn't him giving Saddam the big bear hug in 1984 or whenever it was he visited Baghdad, to step forward and say, look, here, let us give some transparency to the decisions we made in the 80s. Let us explain now why we regret them, why we took them, why we erred in our judgment. And yes, I mean, I think it's an ideal opportunity if we're going to speak in the name of human rights and set up these courts and perhaps intervene in other places, and justify it on behalf of human rights. We have to get away, I think, from what I've started to call the a la carteism of American foreign policy, which is to think that we can just have a conversation about a specific country within the four corners of that country and think that the decisions we make, whether it's backing the Saudi regime or, you know, refusing to relax intellectual property, you know, patents on AIDS and TB drugs, or whether it's talking free trade, on the one hand, and then, you know, having farm subsidies on the other, whatever our decisions are in other areas, climate change, the mm-hmm. International Criminal Court, they all have bearing on the way people are going to see our decisions that are justified on human rights grounds. And so I think it's a perfect time, if we're serious about integrating our interests and our values, to actually reckon across the board with the grave inconsistencies in our policies.
Now, Charles, you know from your time in Iraq, but also your involvement dealing with the U.S. government, that there is still this nasty split between State Department and Defense over what works best. Are you concerned that what Samantha's describing, the opportunity to make a grand gesture, is going to be hobbled by a government which still really can't decide how it wants to act or be seen to be acting?
No, I am very concerned about that, because what I've seen in Iraq is, a government which really is not willing to take the full responsibility of leadership to deal with what we've created in that country. I mean, we have smashed the previous system, and we have an obligation to rebuild it. And I think that we have to make a long-term commitment. It's going to cost a lot of money, and it's something that I think the president has said that's what our policy is, but on the ground, I don't see that being implemented, and I think that uncertainty is causing a lot of doubts in the minds of the Iraqi people. But on the broader question of consistency in foreign policy, I mean, the fact is that the overwhelming power of the United States puts us in a unique position where we're looked upon by everyone in the world who want to see consistency in our actions. And it's going to be very, very difficult, because foreign policy is a field that doesn't lend itself well to that type of idealistic approach. But I think that step by step, we have to move towards that. And I think actually the United States has been the leader in all that. And the criticism that we get from European countries for not supporting the International Criminal Court or other international agreements is really not all that honest, because we have led in identifying human rights issues around the world as a basis for our foreign policy, and we've probably done more to promote that than any other country that I can think of. And so I think we have to focus on the positive aspects of this, and in this case, do everything we can to try to build the rule of law and democracy in Iraq, because that's the commitment we've made to the Iraqi people.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Samantha, will it make a difference, looking a month or 6 months ahead, if the British judicial system, if the sort of involvement of those two Commonwealth partners, Australia and Britain, who were in on the original attack, can that soften some of this concern about the U.S. bringing in its own sheriffs?
Look, I think one of the things that we should say right here and now is that this court is not going to satisfy everyone in Iraq ever. And what we're trying to come up with now is the least bad option for dealing with again, the kind of systematic horror.
That's depressing. Is that the best that we hope for, the least bad?
Sadly, when you come in after the fact, after, you know, nearly 200,000 people have already been killed, and after, you know, perhaps over a million have gone through the prison system and been tortured, many more than a million probably. Yeah, unfortunately, you're not going to satisfy anyone. It will help, perhaps, to satisfy more external constituencies, I think, to have that kind of international involvement. But I think, as both of us have been saying here, this is an Iraqi court system that we and our allies, hopefully, will have more of them as the days pass, can assist in strengthening. And we should be looking at this as an opportunity, while people's attention, ours in terms of outsiders and the Iraqis themselves in terms of people just getting over these horrors, people's attention will be focused on these trials. It's a golden opportunity to actually use this in a kind of Trojan horse way to leave a legacy that will allow the Iraqis to deal with day-to-day justice, because as we all know, the long-term security of that state is dependent on the building of the rule of law. And this, you know, high-profile set of trials is just one step among many along that road.
Right. Key point that Charles made earlier in the program, that this can be one of the foundation blocks for justice in that country. Samantha, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Samantha Power, author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Charles Forrest, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Charles is head of Indict in London, seeking to bring Iraqi war criminals to justice. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation in the forum sections of our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.